Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Nair FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on this episode we're bringing you the second part of John Dorney's interview with Declan Power about his book The Siege of Jadotville. It's also been recently made into a film by Netflix. If you want to listen to previous episodes of the show, go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Irish History Show, or Twitter, @IrishHistoryPod.
The relief had failed. They were out of pretty much food, water, ammunition. Now, what happened at this point is contentious. Different people will tell you different things based on their memories. And you've got to remember, sometimes guys, just because they've been at a thing, they only know their little bailiwick. Quinlan and his men had fought the gendarmerie to a standstill. What they didn't know, and again, this comes back to bad coordination and planning at UN headquarter level, lack of proper intelligence gathering and interpretation by the UN, they could have had a different outcome. Because the mercenary-led forces, the morale had been sapped completely. But they had no real success. The native troops at this stage were really losing the will to fight. And there had been a number of instances seen in one of the more recent attacks towards the end of complete routs occurring and mercenary officers taking out pistols to shoot native troops to stop the complete rout. Had the UN not been so namby-pamby and goody-goody about the use of its broadcast communications, had they used that strategically to broadcast to the native populations and troops via the radio stations that existed, and even by megaphone diplomacy means, the fact that, you know, why are you fighting in a fight that is not yours? You in the right tribal languages, they could have assisted that route. They could have ensured that there could have been a complete mutiny or just a complete withdrawal from the field of the Katangan forces. Had the intelligence apparatus been working properly and had they been aware of that, they could have informed Quinlan, project more strength than you have. Maybe launch an attack from your positions. Just move 100 metres into their territory and take up a defensive position. Bluff them, convince them that you're in a better position, that you're not as low on ammunition, because their will to fight is so sapped. But it was at this point that they sought a ceasefire. They'd looked to have a few short ceasefires before that in order to withdraw casualties off the field and, as you know, humanitarian gesture. Where he has been criticised in purely military circles in terms of studies that have been done of this is that the argument was made, had he been a bit more aggressive, you know, even in the early stages, had he actually manoeuvred the men out of their trenches to follow through on the initial success of their defence, that he might have completely broken the back. I don't think it's completely true, but it's worthy of debate. It's very hard to have reasoned debate about this. Quinlan's defenders get all emotive, especially people that were there. They're not applying logic. They don't want to hear any criticism. In fairness, it's minuscule, the amount of criticism that could be levelled at him. Because manoeuvring his men out of well-prepared defensive positions could have been very foolhardy. And you know what? Especially when it turned out that they had air support that couldn't be countered. It's like the argument that had they been more aggressive in spirit, they should have moved out of their positions and fought their way to Lafura Bridge and linked up with Force Cain. And if they came at the rear of the mercenary forces, it could have been a shock. That's true, but at this stage, his men had been fighting solidly for 3 or 4 days. They were low on food and water, so they were tired, they were low on ammunition, and they would have had to make it through scrubland and bush, and they would have been subject to the strafing. So again, I think he made the right tactical decision there. And I think he made the right strategic decision too, in that it wasn't about maintaining his mission, because his mission was to defend the townspeople. The townspeople were no longer at risk, and he hadn't been told anything about the importance that this was an important strategic position to hold. It wasn't about Jadotville falling that was going to cut, you know, block main supply lines or allow the mercenaries get around the rear of the UN forces. There was no strategic imperative other than the protection of the townspeople. They were involved now. They were assisting in the attacks on him.
Yeah, so it's not a Srebrenica situation.
No, it's not. And if it had been a Srebrenica situation, I don't think he would have considered doing anything other than fighting to the last bullet and the last man. And in fact, he said in one of his radio messages, when he asked how they were holding out, you know, he's alleged to have said, "We will fight to our last bullet, could do with some whiskey." Personally, I don't believe the whiskey bit. I think that there's some of this stuff that has got hammed up over the years. Quinlan, in later years, did become an alcoholic due to his frustrations. But at that time out there, he was a serious professional soldier. And I think that's, you know, hindsight looking back, people throwing something into the wash. It gets said in the film. Personally, I wouldn't have put that in because it's just too stage Irish. Yeah. Oh yeah, we're the Irish. Give us a bit of whiskey and we'll fight on.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of fighting Irish stereotypes around at the time, wasn't it? Coming back to something you said there, where Quinlan's men and his supporters don't want to hear any criticism. Is that to a degree because at the time, the Irish Army considered what happened at Jadaville somewhat dishonourable.
Yeah, it's a backlash, it's a counterbalance to that. And it hasn't helped cogent and rigorous analysis take place. I think the battalion commander may have made some operationally bad decisions. Naive decisions were made because people were learning as they went along. Certainly the bigger issue of blame lies not at Irish battalion leadership level, but at the UN mission leadership in Katanga. What were they doing blundering around the place and not thinking about this force that they had sent out and leaving them there? As happened, they became propaganda prizes. Quinlan was asked for a ceasefire on humanitarian grounds. He agreed to it. They said neither of us know exactly what's happening in Elizabethville. He was being told in radio messages conflicting things at one point that they had everything sorted and another point that we're still fighting. He was looking for support and they were literally explaining why there were difficulties in that back in headquarters. So he agreed to the ceasefire because what difference was it going to make? It was going to prevent loss of life, unnecessary loss of life. He thought that he might be able to kind of keep things on an even keel until a larger body of UN reinforcements arrived. Either
Maintain a ceasefire.
He agreed to the ceasefire. Part of the terms of the ceasefire was there would be joint patrolling by his forces and the gendarmerie forces in order to reassure the locals that the fighting had stopped and that it was safe to move about. And he felt very strongly that their mission was not a warlike mission. It wasn't about winning a war. It was about trying to improve stability and that this was in keeping with his overall mandate. And yet he wasn't giving ground. His men were still in their positions, ready to defend them. This is where he started to get outmaneuvered. I look at it objectively and I think it was completely understandable. He was reporting by radio back to his headquarters. And he was saying that even if you can't get a ground force to me, which they couldn't through the Fira Bridge, even if one UN jet overflies our positions in a show of force, that will enable us to stay in position. They will be loath to attack us if they think they're going to come up against the machine guns of a UN jet. Because a proper UN jet would have been way outclassed. The Fuga would have blown it out of the sky. He was being told tomorrow, that's going to happen tomorrow. And a couple of days passed and, there's a delay. And he was getting all of this confused and ambiguous information. And in fairness to the guys giving it to him, the fault lies at UN headquarters and the fact that they didn't pre-plan this and that the diplomacy wasn't working to get them through the airspace. Quinlan has left. He's a few days in this situation. He's coming more and more under pressure now. Now this is where he gets outmaneuvered. He's left to his own devices by his headquarters. His men look like they're still in position to defend themselves, but he knows that they were out of ammunition and that they're tired and water has been cut off to their positions. This is where the bit of the I start the book with, when he goes into town, he has to buy beer because there's nothing else to buy, happens in the immediate aftermath of the battle during that ceasefire. And so there's this unusual, edgy ceasefire. The mercenaries are in town, they're drinking. He and some of his men are going into town. They meet them personally.
That was actually after the battle.
It was after the battle. And I know in the film it's kind of portrayed beforehand. There was an instance where he ended up in a drinking session with one of the mercenary officers. Godfried Manungo was the Minister of the Interior for Katanga. Quinlan up until this point had been dealing with kind of mercenary officers. He arrived in situ. Now we're talking about a very wily, experienced, highly educated, senior Katangan politician, black African, who sat down, congratulated Quinlan on the stand that his men had put up. He said that they were very impressed, that they admired them, they regarded them well, but that it's a shame that the UN, other UN forces hadn't observed the rules of war and fought as honourably as Quinlan had, and also been praised for his humanitarian gesture in allowing the ceasefire and bodies to be collected and things like that. Told them that they had accounted. This is probably where the figure of the casualties came from. The mercenary officers were the only ones who got coffins. Bodies were being removed at a later stage, when they were in captivity. They saw jeeps would arrive to the area they were being held to get a flag and to get a coffin. And for the amount of coffins that they saw, if they were officers and they were in command of X amount of number of troops, you could extrapolate from that. So from both Manungo and from that kind of extrapolation of seeing coffins and flags being sent off for burials, they were able to gauge that they had accounted for about 300 of the enemy. Manungo said to him at the end of the day, "I can't guarantee your safety if you stay in those positions. There's a lot of people, while we know that you've behaved honourably and professionally, there's a lot of villages around the area that their menfolk are not coming home to tonight. And these people can't be controlled for much longer." Burgomeister told him that there was going to be a mob of people who were coming down. And Quinlan said, "Well, if they do and they attempt to penetrate our positions, I will give the order to fire." It was psychological gameplay. They were trying to say, "You'll be responsible for the deaths of civilians." He was saying, "Look, it's very clear where our positions are. They'll be told if they advance past a certain point, we'll open fire." So he held the bluff on that one. But when Manungo was telling him about this, he knew that he was getting into sticky territory. Also, they manoeuvred in much more forces into the area. That's when they came to be up They reckon there's about 3,000 forces ranged against, much closer to the positions as well, the outlying areas. Their ability to defend their positions now at that point would have been completely untenable. But at this point, Quinlan realised, if battle was joined, that they were already making the excuses of why, they were creating an excuse of how to set off another confrontation that they could explain to the media, and his men would be slaughtered, and they wouldn't even get a chance to explain their position then.
Was he maybe thinking of Nyemba? Did it cross his mind, do you think?
Well, I think it did. It was a different situation, really.
In terms of being, hacked to death and so forth by a vengeful mob kind of thing.
Well, I don't think he was worried about being hacked to death by a vengeful mob. I think he felt that they had enough capability, low on ammunition as they were, to be able to break the back of any kind of a mob coming to attack them. But that then the real forces could sweep through them and they would be annihilated. And then the Katangans would say, well, we had a ceasefire, but then the Irish opened fire on unarmed civilians, and then our forces came in to protect them and had no choice but to destroy them. For a commandant, the equivalent of a major, I think he was thinking well out of the box and beyond, in terms of how this could pan out and how he and his men and the UN forces could be made to look in as best he could. And then he was also thinking about the welfare of his men. So Munungo presented him with a fait accompli and said, look, your position is untenable. You know it. We've got the forces in place. We can pretty much take you when we want to. Do you really want to get your men destroyed for nothing? And he put in front of him a document saying that in view of the situation and to prevent further loss of life, that he, Commandant Pat Quinlan, was agreeing to the terms of surrender of the Katangan forces. And it was signed by him and Godfrey Munungo, the Ministry of the Interior. That document, it's reproduced in the back of the book. It's in military archives. It exists. That's when the surrender took place. So there was a hiatus. And the reason a lot of Jadaval veterans, a lot of the junior enlisted rank and file, hate, and say, oh, we never surrendered, is because initially, when Quinlan came back to their lines and they got orders that filtered down to destroy the heavy weapons, to take the firing mechanisms out of the Vickers machine guns, to destroy the engines of the armoured cars, and then to form up, and they were marched out of their positions, they thought they'd won. At that point, they thought they were being marched out, that an agreement had been come to, and they were marching back. They were going to be met with transport, taken back to Elizabeth, and be lauded for their brilliant stance. They were marched to a hotel in Jadaval. Initially, the rank and file thought, oh, we marched to a hotel, and we're being put up, and whatever else. And at this point, Quinlan was fearful. He was fearful that now they were pretty much disarmed. They still had their sidearms, but I don't think they had any ammunition at this point. And they were kind of allowed to hold on to them for cosmetic reasons. Mm. But then at the hotel, they were fully disarmed. And they were allowed to hold on to their field cookers. And they were given some petrol, because they were petrol, ran on petrol, these old-fashioned field cookers. Mm. And he gave orders to some of the officers and NCOs to get bottles and make Molotov cocktails and put them on the roof of the hotel. Because they were told then that afternoon they were to assemble in the garden of the hotel. And he really feared that they were going to be massacred.
But this is the vengeful mob territory here.
Well, not so much vengeful mob, but that they were going to be just executed.
By the Katangans.
Or that there was a very strong, that if not all of them, that some of them, reprisals would be taken. They were concerned now because they had seen themselves the coffins, and they knew that there was a lot, that accounted for a lot. And they thought, well, we're not going to get out of this. They also kept saying, how many did you lose? That was another thing in the negotiations and the different points.
The Katangans,
yeah. And when he was in the bar with the mercenaries, they all thought that there was a lot of Irish casualties. Because at one point, the Fugajet, the mercenary pilot, flew over and he counted what he thought were bodies. But they were probably bedrolls, because they used to put them out behind the trenches if they needed them at night or whatever else, but they would have been taking up too much space. And so he thought they were body bags. This came back through word of mouth or whatever else, and some English reporters reported it. Back in Ireland, this stage, there were reports in the newspapers, and I think even in RTE, that there were figures of 30-40% casualties of Jadaval. And then there was reports that came back, again, quite a number of days, weeks even, after they ended up in captivity, that Jadaval had been overrun and there were no survivors. So it wasn't until they ended up in the hotel that then, after a few days there, and they were paraded, and Munungo told them, you are now prisoners of the Katangan regime, but we are not like the Indians. We will treat you honourably, and we will treat you according to the rules of war, and you have no fears from us.
We're not like the Indians is a reference to what?
To the Indian contingent of the UN forces that had killed prisoners and had killed civilians. And there was bad feeling. Like, it could, had the Katangans not had a good command and control system, both politically and the mercenary officers, let's be quite clear about it, that were white, French and Belgians, who had a beef with the UN, but who probably had quite a lot of sympathy for the Irish and related to them. Like, would have fought against them, as they did effectively in the field, but they certainly weren't going to gun them down in cold blood. I don't think enough has been made about that, in fairness.
It's almost 18th century professional soldier type stuff, isn't it?
Well, you know, while they were in captivity there, it was quite a benign regime, and Quinlan got to know his captors fairly well, and he used to go down to the guard room to talk to the officer in charge, and they'd chat, they'd have a cup of coffee, probably even a drop of whiskey or whatever else. The reason they were being kept there then became apparent some days or a week later. An entourage of international media were brought to see them. And there's footage that exists to this day that shows the A Company guys being, you know, their field kitchen is set up and they're being fed and they're all smiling, and you know, it's a great propaganda coup for the Katangans, and this is beamed all over the world. It was a great relief for Irish families to see that their men were alive, great relief for the Irish government as well. It was a nuisance for the UN because it was a great propaganda coup, and in the film it sort of tries to address that, but not fully, that this is why, like, you know, the UN were made to look bad because you surrendered. Yeah, it was the UN's fault anyway, because some of their forces had acted improperly, and I would argue that excessive behaviour by the Indian UN forces at the time was down to bad leadership at the top of the UN mission. This the frustrations because there wasn't clear strategic objectives being set by this melange of people who were trying to work both a civil and a military operation into one. Like, there's doctrine for all that kinds of thing now, and even at that it can still be messy, but it must have been an untold demonic type of Irish stew that existed in terms of command and control in Elizabethville.
And so finally the Irish prisoners were exchanged, were they, back to the UN?
Yeah, after the propaganda coup they were moved to Colwazy, where there was a type of prison camp there. And that was much harder regime, and there were busts through a few areas, villages where people had lost men in the Jadaville engagement. And there was periods where they were parked there and a lot of women came out of screeching blue bloody murder, banging the sides. It was psychological operations again, just to kind of remind them, you're surrounded by these places. You know, even if you do break out of the prison camp, your chances of getting back to Elizabethville in one piece are pretty slim if these people find you. And it did, it worked pretty well. Like, the lads were petrified. Also, they got a bit of rough treatment at the start. They were being searched as soon as they left the buses on arrival at the camp. There were still some mercenaries officers in the vicinity, but there were much less in evidence. Now it was mainly indigenous forces, the ordinary rank and file, and the initial officers they were dealing with were indigenous as well. So, you know, even just in terms of language difficulties, and there wouldn't have been the same common ground. And there would have been a bit of the old black-white thing as well. These would have been guys who, now these white guys were their prisoners, and they were going to show them who was boss. There's been all kinds of stories told about it. They treated them harshly. They were, like, initially, when they were being searched, if they found, as they did, some guys still had the odd round, the odd bullet in the pockets of their uniforms. One fella came up to Lieutenant Noel Carey, white in the face, because he could see what was happening as they were filing off the bus, and fellas were getting better around the place. And he had a grenade in his pack that he probably hadn't even thought about, or he'd forgotten about it. Or maybe he had it there if worse came to the worst. And now he was petrified. What was he going to do with it? And Carey took a load of different things, both the odd few rounds, a few bullets, a bayonet or two, and a grenade or two, and managed to shove them down the back of the bus seat. So that led to a few fellas not getting as badly treated. But there were rifle butted and prodded, and fellas got roughed up and black eyes and battered heads. And Quinlan was, you know, and he saw this, apparently he went white in the face and went up to the officer in charge and demanded to know who was the commanding officer, and that they stop at once the brutalisation of his men. It was a junior native officer. Quinlan is an example of the use of moral authority too. I mean, he was unarmed, he was in no position to make any demands, but he carried himself well. His physical presence, posture, presence, profile, as they say, is so important, and his use of command, presence, and his voice, it made this young officer think twice, and he got his men to calm down. But they were kept there for a while, about 6 weeks or thereabouts, and they were exchanged then for prisoners taken in Elizabethville and bussed back to Elizabethville. And that was that then. They were distributed, they rearmed when they got back into the battalion. They were towards the end of their tour of duty anyway, but the whole Katangan mission was ramping up. It's interesting, on a broader note, what happened was you had a new Irish battalion coming out while the 36th was still there. Now, normally they would just rotate, and when they rotate, they do it in what's known as chalks. So you don't have one battalion arrive and the others just get on the plane. One battalion arrives, and they arrive to the headquarter area. They're in segments, and then those segments are distributed out into the different positions, and there's a period of handover. So there's a gradual application of the new bunch and withdrawal of the old bunch. While that was an operation, I think it was Operation Sarsfield was being planned. So it was obviously the Irish that had the particular planning role in this. And that was to lead to what was known as the Battle of the Tunnel. And this was a new attempt to disarm the Katangan regime. And this was largely successful. It wasn't the final act in the Katangan War of Secession. As Churchill might say, it wasn't the beginning of the end, but it was the end of the beginning. It was successful. If not the only time, or one of the only times, you had two Irish battalions committed to an action. For a little country like ours, that's a significant number of troops. Mm. That was about between 12 and 1500 troops, I would say, that were involved in that action. Not all of the A Company were involved in it, though. What happened was they got ordered, they were in the process of rotating. Half of them were rotated back home not too long after Jadava. The other half were involved in the Battle of the Tunnel. There were three men from A Company that fought in the Battle of the Tunnel that were decorated for their leadership and resourcefulness under fire. Then these guys, after that attack, they got rotated back to Ireland. And apparently, it would have been when those troops would have come back, I think, because Quinlan was still out there, that there was this torchlight procession. They came back to Ireland, to Dublin, obviously, then down from Dublin by train, and they were met by the townspeople of Athlone when the word got out at the train. And there were all of the civic leaders were there. Quinlan, just outside the station, there's a photograph of him, I think, in one of the books. He's making a speech in response to the homecoming. And then there was a torchlit procession from the railway station to Custrin Barracks. All of the Athlone people had so much invested. Not all the soldiers came from Athlone, but the critical mass did, or they were based there. So Quinlan, in the terms of the people in Athlone and that, was a god, because people's fathers, brothers, sons had come home intact. It was like a resurrection of the dead to these people. To those people at that time, Quinlan was God. He had brought their men home. He hadn't just brought their men home. He had brought their men back from the dead in their eyes, because they had already buried them psychologically. They had been told they were dead. Liam Donnelly's wife, Captain Liam Donnelly, had her... Donnelly's father was an officer in the army as well. He would have been a colonel at that stage. And at one point he came to the house with a chaplain to tell her that it was highly likely Liam was dead. She was convinced for a 48-hour period that her husband was dead. That was happening throughout Athlone, throughout parts of the country. And so for them, these men then to come home and under Quinlan's stewardship. And that's why the bond of the Jadava veterans is so strong with their commanding officer, even though he's been dead since 1997.
So the idea that the men of Jadaville were in disgrace in Ireland is kind of a half-truth then?
That's a very interesting point. It is, actually, yes, to be bluntly accurate about it. It's become fashionable now, and it does take a film before it gets critical mass. But even when the book came out 11 years ago, and there was a flurry of awareness about it in the media here in Ireland, yeah, it kind of became the fashionable thing to say, oh, these men were in disgrace for 55 years. Initially, within their own area, it was just relief and delight. And then, gradually, Jadaville wasn't being talked about. His recommendations for medals weren't acted on. And it's not that anybody stood any of these men up and said, you're a disgrace and you've let the side down, or that he himself was told that officially or in any documentary way. It was a gradual, insidious thing. At the lower rank level, it was a bit blunter. Disgrace, really, where you guys who hadn't even been in the Congo in some cases, calling men cowards and, you know, sneering at them. And, you know, it led to very nasty fistfights. It was an unholy row in the Curragh when the Western Command troops, as they were then, so these were troops from drawn from Athlone, Mullingar, Galway, Finner Camp, who were arriving to form up and train for probably another battalion to the Congo. And the Eastern Command, the Dubs mainly, and the border units. And of course, the Dubs probably couldn't resist the temptation to have a sneer at them and call them Jadaville Jacks and White Feather. A rowdy, noisy canteen with a lot of young, testosterone-fueled men. And the Western Command men, even though I don't know was there even anyone from Jadava there at the time, but they weren't. This is a slur in their honour. And as a fella said, the belts came off. At that stage, soldiers used to wear these big leather belts around their tunic, and they laid into each other, laid holy hell out of one another. And the military police had to be called in and literally batten them apart, and guys had to be taken to hospital. That's one example of how emotive it was. At a more senior level, at a commissioned officer level, there was the odd eruption in the odd mess in different places when a drink would be taken. But for the most part, it was much more genteel. It wasn't what was said, what was unsaid. and things were whispered about. And the junior officers who served there told me themselves that you didn't talk about being at Shadova. It wasn't something that you wanted to draw attention to because it was bad for your record. It's a hard one to say that Pat Quinlan was discriminated against on one hand, because he retired from the army as a full colonel. There are guys I know who will have gone through the cadet school, made the army their career, and they'll retire as lieutenant colonels, if they're lucky. So to make it to full colonel, the next rank after that is brigadier general. So it's an indicator of a pretty good career in some ways. But he never served overseas again. And even though he held some fairly important appointments, like he was battalion commander up in Kahalbrua Barracks in Dublin. Yeah, he had served in headquarter appointments in Athlone. I think he was the senior instructor on the command and staff course, like the postgraduate qualification for officers to go on to higher rank. He was known as company in defence and defence postures and, you know, deploying weapons in support of different scenarios. He could do this in his sleep. But there was a lot of backstabbing and back talking going on that affected him hugely psychologically. And he was badly, badly treated by his own in that regard, and sneered at by people that had never heard a shot fired in anger. And it definitely contributed to the poor man becoming far too fond of alcohol.
And it seems very harsh. I mean, you know, they seem to have actually done quite well, you know, given the circumstance they were in the Congo.
They did. They did do quite well. But you've got to remember the broader context. Ireland was a very new state, still finding its feet. It was the era when the Magdalen laundries were at their height, when clerical abuse was at its height. And when I say abuse, I'm not just talking about sexual abuse. I'm talking about just how elites within Ireland abused their position. Ireland was particularly at that point very much a class-ridden society. You know, there was very little attention or interest shown to people in the margins of society, you know, in minority groupings or you know, the working class or the rural working class. They were appallingly treated and let down by their political leadership in general. So why should we be surprised that a bunch of troops, people who couldn't understand, whose only understanding of what they had been through were cowboy films and a few World War II films, thought they knew better and thought they could pronounce on these men? Why, we shouldn't be too surprised. And also, it wasn't articulated properly. Our politicians, who are to this day woefully, militarily illiterate, didn't understand. To be quite honest, Niemba was a disgrace. There should have been an inquiry into that. You know, heads should have rolled, not just within the Irish battalion, but at UN level as to why those men were deployed so ineptly and briefed so poorly. Yet Niemba was seen as some sort of a pyrrhic victory, great martyrdom, and you know, everybody knew about Niemba. Jadaval was a professional application of the force of arms, of the profession of arms. They did their job as best they could without any support. It was a huge success story, but it was buried because of people that either didn't care or that were ignorant of the facts. Where the army were seen as, it was seen as a backwater. And enlisted troops were seen as little more than sort of serfs. People would look down their nose at them that had no business looking down their nose at them. Even to this day, but certainly in that era, the army is a very harsh and unyielding and exacting mistress. And a lot of men have served in the army at a variety of levels where you can get in under your skin in terms of the sense of loyalty and camaraderie. And there's this irrational connection to it, you know, tribal connection, which is as it should be, really. But on the negative side, that connection then sometimes enables you to put up with untold bloody-mindedness. And there's very few people, if they've served long enough in the armed forces in general, or certainly in our defence forces, that don't have some story to tell of bloody-mindedness and nastiness in terms of how they were treated at some point in their career. The guys at Jadava, they learned very quickly, okay, this is a shit sandwich, but I have to eat it and I get on with it. What am I going to do? If I'm staying in the army, I suck it up because I want to get promoted, I want to do well, I want to be able to provide for my family. I have a good job in a country at a time when jobs were very hard to come by. And they were believers and they were loyal to the army. But then there were a whole lot of guys who were trying this out. Some of them decided to make a career of it. Some of them didn't. Maybe for some of them in the Jadaval case, Jadaval copper fastened their mindset that they didn't want to make a long-term career out of it. Some of them who undoubtedly had post-traumatic stress disorder. You see, the thing was, the fighting at Jadaval and the initial period afterwards was easy for those guys to deal with because they were together and they'd been through it and they relied on each other. But when they came home, and when they came home particularly to a public that hadn't a clue what they'd been through, and a body politic that hadn't a clue and cared less really about that aspect and were only interested in getting the mileage out of it for look at Ireland on the world stage. And okay, there's nothing wrong with that, but if you're going to do that, make sure you properly look after the men that have presented you with this fait accompli that made Ireland and take our place amongst the nations of the world, to paraphrase Robert Emmet. It was the defence forces and their activities on UN missions that largely made Ireland be seen as a grown-up nation by its partner nations, particularly within Europe. But, you know, there was a lack of knowledge about these things. And I suppose, not to be too hard on Irish society, we weren't the only part of the world. The Western world in general had still to learn about PTSD, had still to learn about the fact that when you take soldiers out of their environment, put them back in a peacetime environment, and they've been through trauma, and they haven't been given the coping skills to interpret what they've been, to unpack it, to place it accordingly, to make sense out of it, particularly the junior enlisted guys who wouldn't have been very well educated at all back in those days. Mm-hmm. And their families wouldn't have had a context to understand it. Now, there are veterans I know who are convinced there were a number of suicides because of it. There were a number of men who became alcoholics because of it. There are a number of men who just, their lives were stunted. Not because of the action at Jadaval, but because of the reaction or the lack of reaction or the lack of understanding by civil society when they came home. People, you know, only see the physical wounds. They don't realise that if you're in high stress environments, and this is not peculiar purely to soldiers, police officers, paramedics, fire personnel, when you're in a high stress situation, that your life is at risk and you know that there's that this could go either way. When you're dealing with it, it's okay. But when you're out the other end of it and you get a chance to look back on it, that can be very challenging for you to put into a context.
Sure. And just to wrap up there, Declan, and we've spoken about the Irish Army's role in the Congo. We've spoken about the Battle of Jadaville, the fallout from it. Just to wrap up, though, as regards the Congo itself, Katanga was coerced back into the Congo as it then was. And yeah, the Congo then became Zaire. Finally, the so-called Democratic Republic of the Congo. None of those states have been very successful. And you have to ask, with hindsight, was it really worth it back in the 60s?
You're right. The Congo, since independence, that's about the only thing it has achieved. It has been a basket case in all those various incarnations you mentioned. And is, to this day, at right now, as we sit here talking about it, is one of the most dangerous parts of Africa. There is a major shooting war going on in the Congo that we don't really hear much about, that the UN are involved in, trying to restore stability. It's a very active phase of operations. One of the few UN missions around the world where they have tanks and artillery and they go on offensive operations and they have special forces units deployed to it. And because there's so many other conflicts around the world and this is deep within the Congo and you have very few media willing to go in there, it doesn't really get reported. In general, I think the Congo's greatest curse was the thing that should have made it one of the most successful countries. The fact that it had all of these minerals, it drew all kinds of attention. It should be one of the shining centrepieces of modern black Africa. And instead, it's an example of... And you can't just lay this purely at the doors of Western powers either. It's down to the fact of swinging like a pendulum. Colonialism is responsible to a point, but also Africa is partially responsible. Congolese Africans who took leadership, who squandered their country's resources, who, you know, raped the resources and betrayed their people and continue to do so. To fully answer your question, was it worth it? I would say yes, for this particular point alone. The deployment of UN forces to the Congo, while it didn't succeed in making the Congo, giving it a stable platform to become a successful state, it did stabilise it enough so that it prevented turning from a Cold War battleground into a hot war battleground. There was a real possibility at one point that you could have had, it could have become a flashpoint in the Cold War that would have led to initially proxy East-West forces coming head-to-head, requiring more and more support from their Soviet and American patrons. And they could have actually kicked off into something that would have gone out of control. You've got to remember that while everybody is familiar, that follows the Congo or reads up about it, is familiar with Katanga, don't realise that there was a northern province called Kasai that also ceded. But it wasn't as wealthy. It didn't have the same resources. And I think Lumumba was still alive at this point, and he got Russian assistance. The Russians gave aircraft and transport for the Force Publique to be deployed quickly up to it. And they went in and they tore the opposition asunder. And they had a little bit of Russian support in terms of advisors and some weapons. And this was an awareness then of, oh, well, what happens if the Russians start to get more involved in providing this? It didn't really see the light of day outside of the Congo because there wasn't the same Western interest in it because it didn't have the minerals. The mere fact that that happened and the fact that Lumumba was so quick to turn from one to the other without realising the consequences. Had the UN force not been there, acting as a buffer zone, a blundering, at times incompetent buffer zone, but a necessary buffer zone nevertheless, That reason alone, and I've said this to Irish veterans, that they should always remember that their service there, hard as it was, sometimes ungratefully responded to as it was, did make a difference. It made a difference that the world could have faced off into a confrontation that was unnecessary. We're talking at the time where the Berlin Wall wasn't that long up. We're talking at a time where there were numerous other confrontations. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened in or around that period in 1961, I think. All of those different flashpoints. Well, this was one less flashpoint that got tamped down.
Thank you very much, Declan Power.
Thank you.
Well, that was the second part of John Dorney's interview with Declan Power about the Siege of Jadafil. Thank you very much for listening. You can hear previous episodes of the show on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. Like us on Facebook, on facebook.com/The Irish History Show, or follow us on Twitter, @IrishHistoryPod. My name is Cathal Brennan, and thanks for listening.